Welcome to the Cascadian Prophets Podcast, a production of the Cascadia Poetics Lab, empowering people to practice poetry and deepen connections to place, self, and the present moment.
Recorded on July 4th, 2023, on the deck of Casa del Colibri, we now present the second and final part of our interview with former Seattle poet Stephen Thomas about his life, his struggles with addiction, and latest book of poetry, What Is Between Us.
I was in my first year in college, and there was a big to-do. A lot of my friends had been arrested the weekend before for occupying a little building on the campus. I hadn't, because I was studying. And the next weekend, there was this party, and I brought this young lady to the party. And, well, to make a long story short, I discovered that I was more interested in the alcohol than the young lady. It quieted down this feeling of unease that I always had in me. Or as we say, hello, hummingbird.
That's not what you say.
No, well, but you got to respond to the mother when she sends a message, right?
Absolutely.
And there was a message on wings.
Well, we don't call it Casa del Colibri for nothing.
Yeah. Colibri, you know the German word.
Is it also German?
Yeah, colibri.
That's funny. I thought it was a Spanish word, and I saw it somewhere else, out of context. I think connected to indigenous hummingbirds in near Harrison Hot Springs. And I said, well, for some reason, they have a Spanish word there.
Yeah, well, it sounds Spanish, not German, but it's the word the Germans use. Anyway, I discovered that I could become comfortable in my skin, let's say, if I had a skin full of alcohol. But the problem with that was I always went too far. The first time I used alcohol, that night, I woke up in jail. And it took me 20 years of wasting my time and my energy to discover that I had a choice. I could either die or I could live. I was seeing a therapist in Madison Park. I'll always remember this guy, Brian DeRoche. I met with him a time or two, and he said, you know, I don't think I can help you, but I think I know who can. He recognized his own limits, and he handed me over. He said, AA. And I tried AA once in about 83, and I thought, well, this is not for me. And all these people holding hands and saying prayers to something that I don't believe in. But I was given what we call in recovery the gift of desperation. I was out of alternatives, and I asked for help, and I found it. And I found that there were different ways of becoming comfortable in my skin. If I just got took responsibility for my own life and got I got the junk of the past out of the way. So I wrote a couple of poems that I didn't know where they were going, but then the poems required a context. And this poem it is one poem. It's a biography in many different little poetic chunks called Jones As Is. And the point of the title, of course, is that it's damaged goods, but you know, you got it, you deal with it. The epigraph, or the proem here, contains Socrates' motto, Nothis Auton, which most people translate as know thyself, but it's a little bit different. So here's the poem. The drunken poet, a cultural type or trope, I've known my share. I became one myself. Gnothi sautam. Get to know is the verb. It doesn't point to the facts. It points to the process. So as we say in AA, you know, you got this thing one day at a time, and you're never done with it. So I've been active in Alcoholics Anonymous for now longer than I used alcohol. And I'm still active, because this is an instance of what goes around comes around.
How do you mean that?
Well, I mean, if you're selfish, then the gifts stop coming to you. And the fundamental gift here is grace.
So because of the grace that you receive by being associated with AA, you're paying it back.
Right. I'm given because I'm smart enough to realize if I try to keep it for myself, it's going to stop working. It's like the Jews wandering in the desert, you know. They got greedy. Okay, we don't want to gather this stuff every day. We're going to gather up manna and have some for tomorrow. No, that's not the way it works. And the Buddhists know this too. Their creation myth follows more or less the same path. You know, people became acquisitive. They wanted more than was given them on the day that it was given. They developed a strong taste for something, and everything became less luminous, more compact, more stodgy, and at once more confused. I'll read you the first poem that I wrote in this sequence. And this just came to me all in a rush. Of course, I revised it a time or two to tighten it up. Jones takes himself seriously. Somebody has to. Look at him count up his sins. This is a game he always wins. Elsewise, he's a restless homebody. Dickinson got to him early, to be nobody. That was his aspiration. Everything he begins, he conceals incompletely. And he pins all his forlorn hopes on anybody's finding a little evidence of his existence, like he might be rescued from sheer oblivion by a future Miss Anthropology, looking for crude artifacts, but finding, gee whiz, a genius, erstwhile misconstrued. That was the first one. I thought, well, gosh, this guy needs more airtime. So I started writing a sequence to fit him in.
Which fits in with the tone of that first one here, doesn't it?
Yeah. So I'm going to read the two poems that lead up to that in the sequence and then skip. This is called Jones First. The taste was hateful. Like something from a swamp, a skunky reek, an irritating fizz. And that was just the beer. The much-prized booze went down like kerosene until the lamp went on, and in its light, the worried boy became the fearless man. And there, too, he was light as air, untouchable, a thief of hearts, and all the simple world is only toy. Oh, he could speak and talk himself both in and out, a dazzler with expertise to spare for all, until a foggy daze enveloping his wit, he poured the gin into his lap and caroled darkness on the lawn and fumbled through the brambles till he bled and heard the cell door slam inside his head and woke in pain and jail, his dazzle gone. And the next poem is called Jones Redux. Now, this is the difference between a normal person and a person like me. He couldn't wait to do it all again. Oh, it would be quite different, of course. He'd stop this time at bulletproof. His dazzle still in order, he would pause. Noblesse oblige incarnate, he would pass out wisdom to the gathered folk and let the witless win a game or two of pool, and save himself and her, whoever her would prove to be, for love and the refinements of the mind. Oh, he was wise and lovable, and one thing he got right. He did pass out.
Gin, huh?
Anything. Could have been anything. Gin fit in.
That's something.
So, what happens with people who are addicted to anything, and it will happen to our culture, which is addicted to gasoline, is you get to a bottom where things are so bad that it's either choose to die or choose to do something different. And that's what we're going through in our culture now. Things are getting...
It seems pretty obvious, doesn't it?
Yeah, it seemed obvious to me for years. Back in the Cabaret Hegel days, I did a piece called Plato Was a Fascist, in which I shot up with salt, with saline solution, as though it were heroin, making the point that I was an image for the culture addicted to petroleum. Anyway, that was back in the 80s. This is now. In 1990, I woke up to what was really happening. This is the bottom. It's a term we use in recovery for the point you reach when you make your choice. It's on page 100. Good page. A man at the end of his tether, a rope around his neck, standing alone on a chair, surrounded by air. Why, having come so far, does he hesitate at this? It can't be simply fear. Fear brought him here. Where does he get the idea that this is not the end? Ideas he's already tried. Philosophers lied. Spinoza alone wrote what's true, but he couldn't get Jones down with his Euclid. At 45, he didn't get out alive. Was Spinoza really blessed as he ground the glass to dust, making lenses for others to use, till he spit blood on his shoes? Nothing he knew or could name could reach into Jones' despair. There was always another trap door to another, an emptier floor, till he came to the floor with his chair, where he found no farther to fall. And something that had no name, having also no use for blame, lifted the noose from his neck, brought his feet to the ground, forced him down to his knees, and taught him his first prayer. Please.
The ending of that poem and the discussion of AA, quoting you, saying prayers to something I don't believe in. Mm-hmm. So the notion of the recovering Catholic comes to mind. So how do you describe, if you do, and could you describe your connection to what those in your past have called God and what might be called the divine life force, or Olson in Projective Verse called it the single intelligence? What's your relationship to that, and how do you visualize it being?
Yeah, okay. When I was a boy, I left my father and mother's home to study to become a priest at the Archdiocesan Seminary, which used to be up near Kenmore at St. Edward's Park now, which is now a high-class hotel. Visited it for the first time a few days ago. I studied theology there. So, and then I went on from there when I realized, like a lot of bright boys at the time, I was abused by a priest and wounded in this encounter. But I met one priest there, John McManus, who saved my life insofar as he showed me how that you could love another human being without using that human being, without making something sexual and abusive out of it. Anyway, I went on to a Jesuit college, Marquette in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Once again, getting farther away from home, farther away from my dad. I studied more theology, I had to. But I also discovered drinking, as described in that first Jones poem. I woke up in jail in the spring of 69. And I kept struggling, and I made a choice as I went to graduate school. I was studying medieval literature, and there the drinking just took over, and I bailed out after 2 years without completing my postgraduate degree, and I took drinking seriously. I kept getting smaller and more shrunken and less connected. And all of the theology that I studied proved to be useless. I'd read Spinoza, Benedictus, as he called himself, and I was interested in his philosophy. I found there was truth in it. But I didn't have any experience that I could connect with it. So what happened is, here I go back to Heraclitus. Heraclitus famously wrote, the road up and the road down are the same road. And what I come to understand that he means about that is that we're spiritual beings having a human experience. So we have no choice in that matter. We're spiritual whether we acknowledge it or not. And if we make the mistake that many people make of equating religion with spirituality, we cut ourselves off from our spiritual natures because of our resentment against the way we experience religion. So the road down is a parody of the spiritual life, which I described in other poems here. It's, you're always searching for something. You're searching for a power greater than yourself. Well, there it is, right there in the bottle. And you become enslaved to it. And your life gets smaller and your choices become fewer. I mean, toward the end there, the only thing that I was interested in was how was I going to get enough money so I could get loaded. Nothing else was of any interest to me. I was writing poems. I had friends. I was interested in women. But the priorities in my life were reduced very small. I went back to graduate school. I left after 2 years with a lot of incompletes because drinking was more important. I got to the point where I had to give up all my ideas because my ideas couldn't help me. And the thing about Alcoholics Anonymous, it's a program it's not a theoretical program. It's a program that's founded on experience. Everything that's worth having there is a result of direct experience. And the 12 steps themselves are only suggestions. They're suggestions, sort of like Buddha said, discover this for yourself. If you want to be happy, here's the Eightfold Path. And AA says, hey, you don't have to do this. Do what you want. But if you want what we got, here's the 12-fold path. And what happened as a result of doing those steps, which began with admitting who I was, that I was an alcoholic, and that I couldn't manage my own life. And then coming to believe that there must be something out there that could save me because I wasn't drinking anymore. I didn't know why. I wasn't doing it for myself. I tried everything I could. And then turning my will and my life over to that something, whatever it was. Now they call it God. You don't have to call it God at Discovery Day, which is a good thing, because I was convinced when I got in there that there was no such thing as God. And I was right. There was no such thing as God as it's defined in the books of theology with which I was familiar.
Bearded, punishing white man in the sky. Is that accurate?
I would call him the judge. Some of his creation sends him this way and some of them that way. I had no experience. What I found out when I followed the instructions, I cleared up the wreckage of my past. And then I became familiar with the things within myself that caused that wreckage. And I made a decision not always to act on them when I was in a triggered state. And then I went to the people whom I'd harmed and I made amends to them. So in there you've got a picture of Sam Hamill. And I made a habit when I was a drinking man of criticizing him behind his back and bad-mouthing him. And it bothered me. This guy was a more recognized poet than I. Okay, he has his own press. Yeah, that's why. I never missed an opportunity to badmouth Sam. And finally I got to, if I want to get Sam off my mind, I got to go make amends to him. I got to admit what amounted to an attempt at character assassination. So I made an appointment with the man. I went out to Port Townsend. He met me at his office at Fort Worden there. I told him why I was there. And he listened to me. And he didn't try to correct me and say, no, no, no. He thanked me for doing that. And I parted company from him. And he no longer obsessed me, so that the next week, when he was on the front page of the local paper for saying no to the Bush White House, and no, I won't go to your White House thing because of the war, seeing his face on the front page didn't bother me. That's one example of the kind of experiences that people have, that I had in AA, which freed me from my past. So that by the time I got through the steps, I'd had experience. And the experience replaced the ideas. And they were organic. I began to learn how to use my mind in the way that it was meant to be used, to reflect on experience and to make choices rather than to imagine a different past and reenact it by going off like a machine every time I was triggered. I began to become a more steady human being and more useful to the people around me. And that's why I continue using the program, because it reminds me of what's true. I mean, I still have a head that tells me things. I have a mind that tells me things every day. And if I'm doing my work right, if I'm staying connected to other people in the program, other people in recovery, if I'm meditating and praying, and you don't have to know who you're praying to. As soon as you say a prayer, you're calling yourself out of yourself. And that's the important step, out of yourself.
I was told by somebody in AA who was talking to somebody who needed AA and was wondering about how it all worked. And he said, well, I don't believe in God. And then they said, well, I have a question for you. Are you God? And he said, no. And he said, that's good enough.
It is indeed.
There's no, when you pray, it doesn't matter that you don't even call it anything or have no word for it?
Well, sometimes I call it Mr. and Mrs. Universe. I've got a poem in here about that. Mr. and Mrs. Universe flexing their fine Austrian muscles. Of course, I'm thinking of Arnold there. Sometimes, like Olson, I don't say the single intelligence. I call it cosmic energy. I call it conscious love. There are lots of different ways of referring to it, but they're just pointers, right? It's the experience that makes the difference. And so I tell people, if you want to read my poems, read them aloud. Have an experience of them. Wrap your lips around them. Use your breath. They'll change your heartbeat. They'll change your respiration rate. And that, after all, is what feelings are. And when you have that experience, then the poem becomes something else. It's not the kind of puzzle of secret code language that our teachers in high school and the university tended to want to convince us it was, so that they could offer their superior view of it and keep us in our lowly places. It's an interchange, an act of equal attentions that calls us out into the present tense.
And what is between us is that space where the poem works.
Indeed.
Yeah. When Olson said that about the single intelligence, he published that in 1950, the year you were born, so we have the benefit of 73 years of refining anything he said in that.
And that's exactly right. Yeah. And when the people who wrote the big books of Alex Anonymous put it out, there were 100 of them, Bill Wilson, I think, was a primary author, at the end of the first 164 pages of that book, they wrote, we realize that we know only a little, and more will be disclosed to you and to us. And this is brilliant, because they didn't say, this is the Bible, every word in here is literally true. They didn't say, this is all you need to know. They said, trust your experience as it discloses the truth to you. So it's like the Buddha. You get across the river, you don't carry the raft with you, you go on.
An open system, one would say.
Indeed.
Yeah. Page 35, America, a True Story.
Oh, yeah. This is from back in my drinking days. Remember the Mariel boat lift?
I have relatives who came over in that boat lift and were kept in prisons in Pennsylvania and went through a tough time before they landed in North Cuba, which we call Miami.
Yeah, North Cuba. Right, indeed. Well, this was... At this time, I was working at Trattoria Michelli's, and we had, you know, who works in restaurants? Well, drunks and immigrants. Drug addicts. That's my experience, anyway.
And people who think a guy named Mitchell could be Italian, right?
Yeah.
Michelli.
Yeah. Well, anyway, Danny. Danny was one of the many people that I made amends to, because I used to work there nights and I'd rip him off just unconscionably because he wasn't paying me enough money. we had this scam. We called it counter scam. If you work in the counter, you can get your desserts without keying into this cash register. We keep track of things. So you could just keep them. It was, this thievery. And when I sobered up, I realized I have to make amends to this man. And I was very generously received. I said, I don't know how much I ripped you off for, but here's a few hundred dollars, which is a lot of money to me now, and I want it to hurt. And he accepted that. I mean, this is just what we do. This is not, I didn't do this because I'm virtuous. I did this because this is me saving my life.
Right. And it's interesting, Trattoria Micheli was that place that you could go to at 2 o'clock in the morning, that and the doghouse, and is no more.
Right.
You can tell you're old when you give directions by landmarks that are no longer there, right?
That's right. Trattoria Micheli, the doghouse, the teepees on North Aurora, Chubby and Tubby. Yeah, Hat and Boots. America, True Story. Yeah, this Phoebe Boucher published this in the Raven Chronicles, and it's in her anthology, Finding the Light, which is a beautiful collection of poems that I'm proud to be in. Freed from Castro's jails, a pickpocket, native habanero, sweet-tempered Pedro of the bedroom eyes. What was he doing here in the gray, wet Pacific winter? And Wen Pu, from the steams of Indochina, another post-colonial transplant. What refuge was there for him under the dull skies of Seattle? Myself, the disgruntled native, never been anywhere, never traveled. Three of us, busboy, kitchen help, waiter, on the night shift in an Italian restaurant owned by an Irish-American drunk. Some things cannot melt. Experience, for one, and the dream of a common language remains, therefore, a dream. Pedro taught me Martí, una rosa blanca. He coached me in Lorca, Toronjas, he said, and I repeated, Toronjas. No, Esteban, no Toronjas, Toronjas. I couldn't hear it, vowel or trill or nasal. It boiled like the song of a river. Still I repeated, Toronjas, Toronjas. As though I could taste or learn how to taste the juice of the noun and the air of the place whence it came. Wen Pu, mounting the stairs with a crate of romaine, looked at me strangely. Toronjas? He asked. I replied, yeah, that's a fruit, I think, in Spanish. Pedro's teaching me a poem. Oh, he sighed, suddenly elsewhere. In Laos, it means, well, never mind.
Grapefruit, no?
Yeah, well, this is from the Song of the Barren Orange Tree by Lorca. Yeah, Pedro was great. He taught me these poems. It was wonderful to imagine a culture where everybody, you know, pickpockets, they know poems, yeah? And they appreciate poets. And I was no better than a pickpocket. I was stealing from my boss there. Yeah?
Yeah. Me, the disgruntled native, never been anywhere, never traveled. Well, you surely made up for that.
Yeah, I left.
Did you get out of the United States while the getting, and here we are on the 4th of July, talking about the good old U.S. of A. Did you get out while the getting was good?
Well, that's not exactly the way it worked out. I mean, I moved out. I left during the second Bush administration. But it wasn't political at the time. My marriage had broken up to my first wife. We remodeled a house not too far from here on 51st Avenue South in Rainier Beach, and we discovered that we couldn't have children, and the pressures in our relationship, the tension between us, was no longer surmountable. We tried, but it didn't work. And I divorced her. I was teaching at an expensive private school, University Prep at the time, and I was looking for something else to do, so this woman, Lorene Clark, who was the diversity director there at the time, really sharp woman, very intelligent, some beautiful, I was kind of stuck on her. She said, well, maybe you should apply for a Fulbright, and I did. apply where? Well, I applied to the Czech Republic, as I've been inoculated with Czech literature by Mark Svenvold when he introduced me to Kundera so many years ago. I read all of Kundera and Josef Skvoreky and other writers, and I thought, well, I want to go there. So I went there for a year, and I met a woman who had a little boy who needed a father, and I thought, okay, instant family. I came back to the States. I gave notice at University Prep. I sold my retirement property in the Methow Valley, and I moved to back to České Budějovice, a provincial capital in southern Bohemia. And it didn't take me more than a month or two to realize I just made the worst mistake of my life. I mean, it wasn't working between us. It was a January and May sort of thing. A guy in his 50s, a woman in her 30s. Yeah, there was a lot of sex to begin with, and then there was none. So I looked around for a job, and I didn't want to come back to the States with my tail between my legs. I needed to discover that there was another addiction that was even older than my addiction to alcohol, which got started when I was 13. It was a sex addiction. And it manifested itself in a lot of different ways. And it was in České Budějovice that I came to terms with that. I went up to Prague every week on a train, a three-hour trip one way, where there was English language AA, and there I met a screenwriter, a Hollywood screenwriter, who shared this illness, and he guided me through those first horrible months as I was realizing that I had done so much damage to myself. And so the things went deeper. Anyway, I found a job in Stuttgart, in Germany, where I'd never been, at an international school. And the next year, while I was there, I met a woman, my wife now, at the Tai Chi studio there. And we became involved with a bunch of leftists who were looking there for a place to buy where they could found, or we could found, an intentional community with an organic farm. And in 15, we found it. In 16, some of us moved out to the village where it existed. That was the year I retired. And in 19, we succeeded in buying it with a loan. And now we live there, and we're trying to figure out how to live in a post-capitalist society, because that's what we believe is coming. We're trying to evolve new ways of making decisions, of communicating and dealing with conflict. And we're operating an organic farm of about 100 acres. We lease maybe 60 more. We raise most of what we eat. And we struggle to free ourselves from old patterns of behavior. It's old, the habit of nurturing resentments rather than solving problems, rather than addressing conflicts. We try to make decisions as a group. And we train young people. Many people come to us. I mean, there are people all over the world, young people who see the end of capitalism coming. I think capitalism, in fact, has ended. What we have instead is corporatism, but that's another discussion. Something's coming to an end, and we're going to need a new way of being on the planet, one that's founded on gratitude rather than on this sense of scarcity. There's not enough to go around. I better get my share. And you know what that leads. That leads to this insatiable grasping after more and more of your fix. This is why we have billionaires. You know, money's not enough. They need more and more and more, even when it ceases to be useful and is destructive in the lives of others. When that crashes, as it must, we want to be there, or at least to have laid the groundwork for new structures. And young people come to us to get trained up in agriculture or community building or communication. And we're there to sow seeds. In the meantime, we're trying to recover the soil there. The Black Forest had been seriously damaged by conventional agriculture and by a an attitude toward forests that they're just, you know, they're a resource that should be used and planned. So the hardwoods, the oaks and the maples and the elms and the linden and the beech and the birch have largely been logged away and replaced with fir and spruce, which grow faster and are easier to market, but they're not the native there. And so the soil becomes acidic, and every 3 years they have to dump huge quantities of lime on the edge of a forest road, and a helicopter comes along with a bucket on it, and a front end loader loads up the bucket, the helicopter picks up, flies out of the forest and dumps the lime. It's absurd. We're trying to do things differently there. I don't know if we'll survive the crash of things, but at least we're spreading something that Joanna Macy, who I consider to be the most important philosopher of the 20th century, has been trying to spread since the late 60s. The work that reconnects, or what young people know as deep ecology. This is a recognition that the times we're living in are critical times, and we probably don't have any right to any hope. Fine. Let's be honest with ourselves. Let's look at the world and despair, and then act as if it could matter what we did. Act as if a different world were possible. The other American philosopher whom I think is important is Charles Eisenstein, and one of his big books is The More Beautiful World We Know, Our Hearts Know, Is Possible. And these are both philosophers who believe in celebrating what is. So it doesn't make any sense if you're just angry and bitter all the time, because that's not attractive. You're not going to get people to adopt a new way of living that expresses itself in bitterness and anger.
Or as Sam Rayburn once said, it takes a carpenter to build a barn, but any jackass can knock it down.
That's exactly right. So the last poem in the book, The Place Belongs to Herself, I've written about our enterprise. And the last section of that poem begins with these two lines. As is, the wounded human world embalmed in gasoline. As if, the path imagination blazes through the looming dark. There's more to the poem, but I want to leave it right there. I want to come back to Joanna Macy, who you can find on YouTube. She's a marvelous, she's in her 90s now, doesn't make public appearances anymore. But she's a practicing Buddhist in the Tibetan school. And she explains Buddhism as well as anyone I've ever encountered in her book, World as Lover, World as Self, a collection of essays from over the last, well, from a long time. It was reissued, I think, last year on the 30th anniversary of its publication with a new introduction. In the new introduction, she says, we're in a place without a map. It's a frightening place between worlds. This is what the Tibetans call Bardo. When you come into Bardo, you meet the Buddha Ashobhyaya. His element is water, and therefore his virtue is strength, his mirror, wisdom. He holds up a mirror, and the lesson of the mirror is do not avert your gaze, do not turn aside, look at what you see. And this is precisely what we need now. We need to look at what's here and stop pretending that we can get away with the kinds of behavior that every day erode the soil upon which we depend and alter the atmosphere that we breathe and produce conditions that allow the forests to break into glorious blaze and drown our cities in fumes. Wake up and look at what is. That's the lesson of Joanna Macy. And celebrate the opportunity to do something new. Because she says, if you're young and 25 and adventurous, you're 25 and adventurous, this is a wonderful time to be alive. Because everything is going to have to change.
It's completely ironic that you're saying this as a man is refueling his boat while leaving the engine on, as if, you know, as if he needs to keep it on for whatever reason. And, you know, I talked to Brenda Hillman about that. What do you do when you see people, you know, running their cars while they look at Facebook and that? And she said, well, I don't think micro-scolding is very effective. You know, and you had that line.
Micro-scolding, yes.
That nurturing resentments rather than solving problems. So, I mean, this community that you're creating is exactly that. And you're walking the walk.
Well, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to walk the walk. I have to admit that when people come to visit us, young people, sometimes they see, oh, this, the vision statement says this. You're trying to find new ways, but this doesn't look new. And it's hard. With people my age who worked all their lives and sunk their savings and their pensions into something like this have a big interest in security. The unfortunate problem there is you can't do something new if security is your foremost need. So we're constantly striving to address the needs of the people in the community that are old, the old triggers. We're inviting people to look at the source of their annoyances and their neediness, and to discover a new way of looking at the world, one that's not based on the sense of separation and of dearth, of want, and changing to a new story, a story of abundance, a story of gratitude, the story of sharing. We're in a middle ground here. We're in Bardo. It takes a while to train people to look in the mirror, because when you look in the mirror, when I look in the mirror, I see an old man. I don't see this sexy dude that goes from reading to reading, attracting the young women. I know, that's not what's happening. What's happening is I'm becoming an elder. And so the poems aren't about my getting my way in the world. The poems are about manifesting and broadcasting the opportunity that people have to be, to participate in a new story, a new myth, one that will last as long as the myth of the flood.
I'm really honored to have been able to capture your story like this and sit here on the deck on a beautiful 4th of July listening to the boats and the occasional osprey or eagle, I forget what it was that was making those sounds, but I'm really grateful for this time, and I wish you much success with all of your efforts, Stephen. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you, Paul. It's been an honor to me, and I appreciate this avenue that you offered to get the words out to a broader public. So you have my respect and gratitude.
What Is Between Us is the book. Stephen Thomas is the author. It's published by Hand to Mouth Books of Walla Walla, Washington.
Cascadian Profit supporters include Diana Elser, a sponsorship dedicated to her parents, whose practicality, humor, and love of family life reflected their experience in and love for the Missouri Breaks and Ruby Valley, Montana landscapes that define their childhoods. And Steinbrook Native Gallery, located near Pike Place Market in downtown Seattle, featuring fine art of the Northwest Coast from emerging and established artists. A link to their site at CascadianProfits.org.
Cascadian Profits is a project of the Cascadia Poetics Lab in Seattle, Washington. Check us out online at CascadiaPoeticsLab.org.